Coming up on Boston Public Radio, Plan B is topic A today, as the Obama administration drops its objection to allowing the morning after pill to be available no matter what your age. Did they make the right move? And then tonight, the Rolling Stones perform one of two concerts at the Garden. Mick Jagger and Keith Richards, both 69. So the question is, how old is too old to rock and roll, Marjorie?
We'll talk with Boston Globe editor Brian McGrory about the $80 million man. Then WGBH's Emily Rooney and Adam Riley about the latest in the Bulger trial, including the juror who slept through much of opening arguments this morning. And then Garen Daly joins us with his list of the best movies about informants, FBI, and otherwise. All that's coming up on Boston Public Radio 89.7.
Local Talk.
He's Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Hey.
You know, what a day in Boston. Bulger, the Bruins, and the Stones. And we're going to cover all three of them.
Very exciting.
First, on Monday, I think you know, the Obama administration dropped its legal challenge to the morning after pill being available to all women and girls, regardless of age. You know, originally their position was that it should only be available to women 17 and older. We're going to get your thoughts in a minute on this politically touchy issue. But first, joining us to discuss the medical ethics questions surrounding whether to provide or not provide Plan B pills to girls under 17 is Art Kaplan. He's head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU's Langone Medical Center. Welcome back, Art.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Great. Hey, Art. So what are the ethical issues here of the Plan B with these young girls?
So first, is it safe? Is it something that you could just take over the counter even at a young age, so to speak? Would you follow the instructions correctly and do it right? Second, where do you put it? Just out with the greeting cards or behind the counter? Third, should young women who, you know, are not fully mature in terms of cognitive abilities be able to access this pill without a discussion with a doctor or without a discussion with their parents at age, say, 13 or 14? I think those are the core ones.
And what were the, other than the politics of it, which of course the Obama administration would not say it cared about, what were the primary arguments they were making that the court found unacceptable about exempting under 17-year-olds? What were they saying?
They tried to go with a safety argument, saying it's not clear that these pills would be taken properly, that you need to have a doctor supervise you. But the courts basically just threw that out the window and said, you have a pill that is basically the same thing as a birth control pill. You're taking it in a little bit more of a dose. A one-time use has no side effects. Your FDA can't show us any side effects. If safety is your worry, forget it.
And just to be clear here for listeners and for me, actually, the Obama administration was not saying that the pill would be unavailable if you're under 17. They just said you'd have to go to a doctor and get a prescription, correct?
Correct. Okay.
Yeah, which I think would take a lot of time for a lot of young women that are in this situation. But Art, you know what I thought would be a nice, I mean, you can't have a government mandate, but if you went into CVS or Walgreens or wherever you went, instead of just being right there next to the greeting cards, as you put it, these pills were behind what they do with a lot of expensive things, and this would be $50 a pop, which is not cheap, obviously. You know, they do it with the expensive teeth whiteners and the electric toothbrushes.
How does that help?
Well, because you'd have to ask someone, and it would be great if you could put it in a position where you'd have to ask the pharmacist, because you might be afraid to tell your parents at 13 or 14 or 15 or tell anybody else that was a responsible adult, but you might be okay telling a pharmacist.
So one of the problems is, if the pharmacist is of the view that young girls shouldn't be using these pills, maybe they're not going to give it to you when you ask. So from a political point of view, we've seen pharmacists say, I'm not prescribing abortion pills. I'm not having anything to do with contraception in some instances. So some would argue, look, the kind of person who comes in who's under 18 who uses this pill is not somebody who's making it part of their lifestyle. It's someone who's being coerced, someone who's being forced into sex, someone who can't tell anybody. That's why you need the easy access.
Well, and by the way, it seems to me some person that would disagree with that would include the district court judge, Edward Corman, who might say that creating that extra threshold that Marjorie described is not what was intended by my law, but by my decision. But it seems to me there's another issue there. You say that these are women in extremists, for lack of a better expression. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But one of the primary arguments you've heard from tons of people is that it's going to make teens believe that it's more okay to have sex, because the reality is you can fix it after the fact, even if you didn't fix it before the fact, right?
Yeah, and I hear that. And I think there may be some reason to think that girls are going to be more sexually active because they know they've got this parachute, so to speak, to save them if they get into trouble and they have unprotected sex. But the real answer to this problem, I think, goes in a different direction.
Which is?
Parents not talking to their daughters about sex. The hiding the pill is not a substitute for having that conversation about when sex is appropriate, abstinence, what's responsible behavior. Parents don't like to do it. They also don't like to talk about contraception. So to me, that's the major protection, if you will, against sexuality at a young age. The pill may be out there, but there's already a significant number of teenagers, as we know, who are out there, you know, doing what they're going to be doing. Parents need to be tougher. And I think that's really, and maybe a little bit in school, too, a little bit more sex ed wouldn't hurt either.
But you know what, Art Kaplan, you must have heard of Becky Bell. Do you remember Becky Bell, the young woman who died from an illegal abortion back, I think, in the 90s? I learned a big lesson by interviewing her parents. She came from what you would say would be the ideal family, young, smart woman, headed for college. She didn't tell her parents she was pregnant because she did not want to disappoint them, because they thought the sun rose and set on that young woman. And that was a big eye-opener to me, that the very best families doing the right thing can get in these situations, and the young girl doesn't want to tell her parents for a whole bunch of reasons, including Becky
that's
Bell's.
True. That's true. And, you know, what I just said in terms of the conversation – it's not perfect. It's just better. I think trying to say we're not going to give out condoms, we won't talk about birth control, we're not going to have a day after pill, then young women will do the right thing. I don't think that follows. You got to start with that core conversation. And as we know from the experience in Europe, sex ed really does make a difference to diminishing unwanted pregnancies.
Yep.
So that's another big step. Then you're going to have some of the Beckys. They will occur. Maybe they would have been helped with easier access to that day after pill. I don't know. There are, you know, it's not a perfect system. But what we do know from hard data is the more you do sex education in the schools, the lower the rate of unwanted pregnancy. It doesn't encourage it. It lowers it. And if parents can have that conversation about abstinence and responsible behavior with their kids and really get into it, I think that's going to help. I don't have the hard numbers there, but I think, you know, if you're betting on just hiding the day after pill as a way to keep your daughter from being sexually active at a young age, I don't think that's the right road.
Is there any evidence, Art Kaplan, though, that either of the things that you think should happen are happening? Tight school budgets, tight local budgets. One of the things that goes is sex ed, health ed, phys ed, all those sort of things. And parents, to me, don't seem to be getting any more open, this is totally anecdotal on my part, with their kids than my parents and their parents were. Is anything moving in the direction you think it should be?
Not right now. I think we're still too restrictive on the sex ed front. There's still too much fighting about, you know, if we explain to them how things work, they're going to go out and do it. Or, you know, I keep laughing. Long ago, I went to a nursing home. I wanted to talk to people there about do they have advanced directives. But I was nervous because I didn't want to get them upset about thinking about dying. And I talked to one lady in her 90s, and I said, you know, before we start this, I just want to warn you, you know, we're going to be talking about something uncomfortable. She said, look, Junior, you're coming here to talk to me about dying? I'm 90 years old. It's occurred to me. And that's my attitude about 13-year-olds.
Yeah.
You know, they think about it. They know about it. It's in the air. It's in the atmosphere. Does anybody remember being 13?
Yes. In constant fear and trepidation, Art.
Hey, Art Kaplan, before we let you go, I'm sure there hasn't been a survey as such. Are you an outlier in the medical ethics field on this, or are you in the mainstream, or most of your colleagues exactly where you are?
Mixed. I think more with me than against me, but there are those who would say, boy, it would be nice to put that at least behind the counter.
Well, you know, the line that I think summarized, Margie and I both read the lead line in this morning's Globe editorial, which I think perfectly characterized virtually every parent in America. The idea of teenagers having unfettered access to the morning after pill makes some parents understandably squeamish. And then they go on to say, but the Obama administration has made the right decision.
Yeah, well, I from their point of view, the Obama administration is not in the police squeamishness business. They're in the, if this is unsafe or poses a danger, then we got something to hang a regulation on. They don't have it. So, you know, it's kind of like, deal with it, folks. Let's get that sex ed going. Let's get that conversation going with your kids.
Art Kaplan, thanks.
Yeah, thank you very much for being with us. I think Art Kaplan would be a good father to talk to sex about, don't you think? I think so.
Send Art. Our kids there. That's a
That's
good
right.
idea.
Art Kaplan is the head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU's Langone Medical Center. Okay, we want to ask you guys at 877-301-8970. You just heard us. You just heard Art Kaplan. Do you agree with the Obama administration saying, okay, we give up. This pill is going to be available to young women of any age. Have you had that conversation over and over and over with your kids? And if you have, do you think it makes a difference? And are you, like me, very squeamish about this whole subject? I mean, the idea of having, like, 13-year-old girls going to CVS or Walgreens and buying this pill without their parents knowing, without their big sisters knowing, makes me very uncomfortable. On the other hand, I think it's a good idea.
I'm
it's
exactly
available.
Where you are. 877-301-8970 is the number. You know, when Art was saying at the beginning, placement is one of the ethical issues. What's the first? Well, you didn't say it, so you might not have thought it. The first thing I thought was, it should go right next to the lobsters at Walgreens, which is what we discussed the other day. 877-301-8970. The Obama administration didn't want it to be available over the counter, the morning after pill, to those under 17. They finally capitulated, went along with the judge and the FDA. So that's question one. When were they right, the first time or now? And secondly, Art Kaplan is right. This is another one of these areas where parents should be taking huge responsibility. I see no evidence in the world in which I operate that most parents are comfortable at all having these conversations with their kids any more, as I said, than our parents were decades ago.
Well, I think it's not just that. I mean, we all want to think, okay, we're going to have these great open conversations with our kids. And you do when they're 7 and 8 and 10. But once you get into like 13, 14, 15, they don't want to listen to you and you didn't really want to have them. So you have to kind of force yourself to do it. But I think teenagers, one of their main goals in life is to hide their lives from their parents. And we like to think we know what our kids are doing. I think most of the time we have no idea what our kids are doing. And that's why I think this sort of thing is a very good thing. 877.
And luckily they have no idea what we're doing either. So it's sort of a
that's right.
An equilibrium.
I do
there.
Know like one or two people who actually like smoke cigarettes. You know, they spent their whole lives trying to hide the fact that they will have a cigarette on their vacation from their kids. It's a reverse kind of thing, hiding from your kids what your real life is. Anyway, 877-301-8970. Mona from North Oxford. What do you think? You with Obama's capitulation, or not?
I totally support the access of young women to Plan B, whether they're 13 or 23. And as far as the cliche of, oh my God, they're going to be right next to the M&Ms and greeting cards is pure garbage. Plan B costs about 40 or 50 bucks a pop. So the idea that random 12-year-olds are going to be running in there blowing their allowance on something like this is garbage.
Yeah, but Mona, if I can, the flip side is I agree the 50 bucks is a daunting notion, but if it's needed, most of them are going to find the 50 bucks. I'm not suggesting they're going to buy it like they buy M&Ms, as you suggested a minute ago, but the reality is readily accessible means readily accessible.
Well,
you need it, you find the 50 bucks.
It's probably going to be behind the counter because it's
$50. It's going to be behind the counter because it's expensive.
Exactly.
Well, I'm not sure either of you are right. And the reason, I agree with the notion that most expensive things, as you said, Mona, and as Marjorie said to Art Kaplan, are behind the counter. But as I also said to Art Kaplan, I think if you have to ask a human being, like a pharmacist for this, I think it potentially violates the judge's order about easy access and kids not being intimidated into not asking. So I am not sure that's the ultimate solution. Mona, thanks for the call.
Have to ask a pharmacist. You do what you do if you're going in to buy an electric toothbrush.
Oh, maybe. Oh, I agree with that. Okay, fine.
You go up to the clerk and you say, I want to buy something in the counter, and they go unlock it for you, and they get it for you.
Well, that's what Mona and you meant, you're right. You're both right.
It's the extra kind of embarrassment thing, which I think a lot of young men can remember when they were going into stores.
Well, but as long as it's not a pharmacist, the reality is it's embarrassing enough when you have to pay for it. You have to pay. You have to talk to a cashier anyway. If it's just somebody to get something from behind a plexiglass thing, then that's okay.
Tracy in the car, what do you think about Plan B being available for girls of all ages?
Well, first of all, I should say I'm pro-choice, pro-education. I am a mother of four, three of whom are teenagers. But I'm also a licensed therapist in the state. And my question is, as a therapist, I'm a mandated reporter. I work with adolescent girls. And by the letter of the law, if you're 16 or under, you can't legally consent to sex. So I'm wondering whether pharmacists as healthcare professionals are mandated reporters and how you basically have that information, and what you do with it. But I'm very much...
That's a great question.
I'm sorry we didn't ask Kaplan.
That's a great question. Well, you know, if they're going around the pharmacist, which they may do, even though I would like it if they were going to see the pharmacist. But our Kaplan had a great point. Maybe the pharmacist is pro-life and is opposed to this sort of thing. They're just going to be talking to the clerk like you do when you want the electric toothbrushes, Tracy. You know what I mean?
Right. I mean, it's a gray area. It truly is
area. Oh, you know what, though, Tracy? You should know this as a therapist, because as you know, what a lot of girls do in the Boston area, they can get to Planned Parenthood. They just get right on the T and they go out to Planned Parenthood and get birth control pills. And they're under 16. Planned Parenthood isn't reporting them.
Well, they very well could be. I mean, you know, it is the letter of the law that 16 or under,
can't consent. You're right.
Reporter.
You know, and by the way, even if it turns out, you know, I just did a very quick search while we're talking, Tracy, not under Massachusetts law, but virtually everything that came up on Google did include pharmacists. And this is, again, just a random search, as mandated reporters. And even if you don't have to go through a pharmacist, it's conceivable a young kid, a 15-year-old, is going to go ask the pharmacist the question about it. And at that point, does he or she have an obligation? Tracy, we're going to find out for you. And what's that?
Some might report, some might not, because it is gray, but by the law, you really have to report. It's mandated, it's out of your choice.
Well, I'm not so sure it's as gray as you think if it turns out they're statutorily covered. Tracy, great point.
But that can't be right, because in Massachusetts, if you're under 18, you want an abortion, and you can't get one of your parents to agree to it, you don't want to tell your parents, you go to a judge. So,
obviously the judge has the power, even if you're a victim of statutory rape, to grant you permission to have an abortion.
But I'm saying,
here, there's no third party.
But I'm saying the people that you would see are not reporting you to the Department of Social Services, the Department of whatever we call it.
But
now,
a judge is in a different state than the, I don't mean literally physically a different state. He or she is in a different place than somebody who's a social worker, as the caller was, or a pharmacist, or that kind of thing.
Okay, we don't know the answer to this, but it can't be right, because Planned Parenthood would be turning in hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of young women that are going there to seek birth control. Let's go to Joe in Boxborough. What do you think about this, Joe?
I think it should be readily available, and it's not going to be next to the Hallmark cards or the M&Ms. It's going to be over next to all the family planning stuff.
Right.
It's not going to be, yes, as a high value item, they may be tucking it away, but that's fine. But it's something that really should be available, and it really is up to the parents to talk to their kids at a younger age, because kids are maturing a hell of a lot earlier.
But do you think you and Art Kaplan are in total agreement, and Marjorie and I are with both of you? Do you think that average parent is having that conversation in a comprehensive, meaningful, understandable way?
Not with young girls maturing at age 9 and 11, no.
Yeah,
not enough.
And that's the problem. And he's totally right, and you're totally right. That's the missing ingredient, which nobody can really mandate. Thanks so much for the call. We appreciate it.
I'm going to give out the email address, because I don't do that enough. It's BPR, as in Boston Public Radio, at WGBH.org. BPR at WGBH.org. And the number is 877-301-8970. The Obama administration has given up. They were trying to set age limits on when you could get the so-called morning after pill, the Plan B pill.
And were excoriated by the court, by the way. The court's position was that their argument about safety concerns was completely phony and was political.
The quote was politically motivated, scientifically unjustified, and contrary to agency precedent. So the judge sort of I would say, disapproved of Barack Obama. Casey in Plymouth, what do you think, Casey?
I hope they're readily available. Even if it's behind a counter, someone is going to just go to their friend's older sister or brother and ask for help. They're going to get it anyway. They're having sex. They're not overly concerned about it. And more importantly, we need to have this conversation with young men, not just young women.
Excellent sex point.
It's the responsibility of everybody.
I wish my father was still alive so you could have a conversation with him, Casey. He couldn't quite reach that threshold, but Casey, you're absolutely right. Thanks for the call.
Okay, coming up next, are you getting your Bruins beard on? Scientific research says that your devotion to hockey also has the proven benefit of making you bearded ones more desirable and good-looking. That conversation is up next. Should you get a new beard or not? 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio. As the Stanley Cup Finals begin tonight, all 12 players on the ice will have one thing in common: beards. In a minute, we're going to ask your take on beards off the ice. Boston Magazine says beards make men hotter, but we'll start with beards on the ice. Joining us from Chicago is Herald hockey writer. That'd be Steve Conroy. Welcome, Steve.
Well, thanks for having me, Jim.
Hey, Steve, good to talk to you. So the Bruins crushed the Pittsburgh Penguins, and they weren't supposed to crush the Pittsburgh Penguins. So what are we thinking now? Are the Bruins going to crush the Chicago Blackhawks too?
I don't think it's going to be that easy. I don't think the Blackhawks are that much better than the Penguins, but I don't know if the Bruins can maintain that level of tight defense for that long. I don't think they'll crush them at all. I think it's going to be a good series. I picked the Blackhawks in seven just because that's what I do. And there's going to be a big loss, and that'll be Gregory Campbell, who I think you know broke his fibula blocking a shot.
That was unbelievable. And then stayed on the ice for what, 30 or 45 seconds continuing to play? It was unbelievable.
He stared down the guy with the puck as well and altered shots and altered passes. He's like the Black Knight from the Monty Python and the Holy Grail.
Yeah, you know, Steve, I have bad news for you. As soon as you said you predicted the Blackhawks in seven, your editor just called and said you can stay in Chicago. So now, for hockey purists, from what I understand, there were originally six teams in the National Hockey League. This is the first time two of the original six have been in the Stanley Cup Finals in what, like 30 years or something? So this is a huge
34.
Deal.
The last one was Montreal, New York Rangers in 1979.
And does this, when something, I'm not a big hockey fan. I've been to one pro game in my life. I went to a Bruin game a couple of months ago. It was wildly exciting. Does something like this, I mean, the playoffs are unbelievably exciting, even to the non-fans like me. Does this elevate hockey's profile in America, or is this simply for hockey fans to be essentially transported to heaven for a couple of weeks?
Well, I think when you have hockey in cities like this, in Boston and Chicago, two great American cities, it will elevate the game a little bit. I don't know how long it will last. Back in the 70s, its profile was elevated because there were good teams in Boston and New York and Chicago. And in the late 90s, early 2000s, some of those organizations hit hard times, and it really hurt the sport, I thought.
Now, Steve Conroy, just to show that I know something about the sport,
which I don't.
Here's my question. So Tuukka Rask, who's the goaltender, who has been unbelievable in the last, I guess, series and a half, if he continues anything like this, does he reach the pantheon of top Stanley Cup goaltenders of all time? Is he potentially in that league?
Oh, yes. Yeah. His save percentage and goals against, he will be the Conn Smythe guy, probably.
That's the MVP, right?
Correct, yeah.
How'd I do with that question? Good?
That was very good.
Yeah, that was impressive. See, because let me tell you, I don't know much about sports, period. And when we get into hockey, I'm really way over my head. But I do know, and I hope you know, about this beard-a-thon that the Bruins are doing. Tell us, people, about that. It's been going on forever, correct?
Yeah, I guess it started with the Islanders back in the 80s.
Yeah.
And now every team does it, you know, when they start the playoffs.
Every player on every team until you're eliminated grows a beard and doesn't shave?
Yeah, there might be a couple of exceptions here and there, but yeah, pretty much everybody at least tries it. Let's say that. It's a good thing Tuukka Rask wears a mask.
Okay. Oh, he doesn't look so good in his beard, but this one especially for us.
A little scruffy.
Right. I've seen that too.
Yeah, the guy I saw that was leading in the beard contest on the Bruins website was Scruffy something or other from Dorchester. I thought that was pretty good. But Steve Comrie, so this one is different, of course, because the proceeds are all going to go to the one fund. So is that how it usually works every year? The hockey players grow their beards and the proceeds go to some great charity?
Well, I think the Bruins started this a couple of years ago. I think in this current regime they started it. I'm not exactly sure which year they started.
Yeah.
But it's been an ongoing thing every year since I would say the past 3 or 4 years at least.
Now, have you grown a beard in solidarity, Steve Conroy from the Boston Herald?
No, I do not.
Okay. You're a wise man. Hey, Steve Conroy, thank you so much. Enjoy the series, and we hope you're wrong.
Okay. Thanks for having me, guys.
Thank you very much for being with us. He's Steve Conroy. He's been covering hockey for ages for the Boston Herald.
Okay, so Bruins players grow beards to raise money for good causes. Some Bruins fans grow beards to show their devotion to the team. In the end, it doesn't matter why you grow a beard. Just having one, you ready for this, makes you more attractive. That's according to a new study, Marjorie. It's published in the journal. I'm sure you've subscribed to this. Evolution and Human Behavior. I love it. But you ever seen the ads in the back?
It's fantastic.
They're amazing.
Very sexy.
Turns out male facial hair and attractiveness are correlated. How much facial hair a man has can determine how good-looking he is to women and men. So we want to know, 877-301-8970. This is our tip of our hat to the Bruins today as they open the Stanley Cup thing. Are you buying it? Are you part of the pro-beard caucus in America? And Marjorie, to prepare for this, I was trying to think, in the last decade, who are some high-profile people who have beards? Al Gore has a beard, and the way people would always say they know that he's running for office, mm-hmm. he'd shave the beard
Correct.
And lose 30 pounds. The former governor of New Jersey, Corzine, is another one.
Yeah.
Osama bin Laden, as one of our colleagues said, obviously is a high-profile
That's
person
right.
with a beard. And there are about 15 people in Congress. But the reality is, unless you're an athlete or you're an actor in some fashion, beards, at least full beards, are not the thing, correct? What they're talking about in this study, in this evolution and human behavior thing, is a certain level of stubble.
Stubble.
Which is not really a beard, but a long stubble. 5 day stubble is apparently the most attractive look on a man. We want to know if you agree. 877-301-8970 is our number, and our email is BPR, Boston Public Radio, BPR@WGBH.org. What do you think?
Well, I think the stubble is very attractive. I mean, don't you remember back in the, was it the late 70s or early 80s?
Was this Miami Vice?
Don Johnson of Miami Vice.
Great.
He had the pink or light blue, Florida colors, and he had the few days of stubble. It was very appealing. You've seen George Clooney once or twice with a few days of growth. Yeah, I think that's...
Who do you know, by the way, who does not shave ever over the weekend and often comes into work with 3 day stubble, Marjorie?
You know, Jim...
Who would that be?
Monday mornings, when I look across my desk, I say, hubba, hubba, hubba.
Thank
it's you,
you very much. I appreciate that. 877-301-8970. It's like our colleagues did some research here. The last president with a beard, as far as Benjamin Harrison, in 1893,
yeah, I thought
he
was
the 23rd president.
Abraham Lincoln.
Listen to these other people: Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, obviously from Iran. Ben Bernanke, I forgot, the
That's
head of the Fed
point.
Has a beard. I hadn't thought of that. And one of the great people on the list, I hope you people know who this guy is, Jimmy McMillan III. Mm-hmm. He's the one who ran, remember in New York State, the rent is too damn high party?
Remember
that guy? In any case, and what's the best beard on Beacon Hill without a close second? Not even a close second.
Quite extraordinary. That would belong, I would guess, to Byron Rushing
from
the South End. It sort of goes out in a million different directions.
I love his
multicolored.
Beard.
It's black. It's gray. It's sort of in between black and gray and all
looks
that kind of stuff.
On him.
You know something else? Men have a great advantage because they can grow beards.
Yeah.
You know, when you get older, it covers your wrinkles. But I remember there was this guy that I've told you the story before, this heartthrob that I used to work with when I was really young who had a beard. Then one day he shaved it off. He had no chin.
No, well, that's why a lot of men grow beards.
He had no chin. We were devastated. We just couldn't look at him as a heartthrob, Jim, any longer.
It's one of the saddest stories I've ever heard. Joe and Needham, you are first on Boston Public Radio. Jim and Marjorie, we're talking about the beard in honor of the Bruins in 2013. Hey, Joe.
Joe, Marjorie, welcome to Public Radio. I'm a big fan. I think you guys are doing a great job.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for taking my call. I'm 42. I've had a beard for 5 to 6 years now, or some sort of facial hair all my life. I'm a huge Bruins fan. I initially started growing facial hair to protect my skin on my chin from the straps on the helmet and the catcher's mask, and in the springtime, and so that just naturally evolved into some type of Van Dyke or goatee, they call it. And I have three daughters. They're six, between very young and 7 years old. They've never known me without any facial hair. And I asked them, I was teasing them the other day, told them that I was going to, thinking about shaving. And my seven-year-old daughter, mind you, said, no, Dad, don't shave. But, if you could just maybe cut out some of that white hair, I love her to death.
But wait a second. I assume you're at a stage now, since some of your kids haven't seen you, you're without a beard. You're probably nervous to ever do it now, are you not?
A little bit. When my sister and I were very young, very quickly, my parents went to Italy for a little while. We went to stay with our grandparents. And when they came back, this was in the late 70s, I guess back then, mustaches were very fashionable.
Sure.
We're waiting in anticipation for my parents to come home from the airport, and we see the carpool in the driveway, and we bolt out the back door, and my parents get out of the car, and there's my dad, this little Irish guy, bald Irish guy with all of a sudden a caterpillar on his lip. My sister, my little sister, who couldn't have been more than 7 years old at the time, did a complete 180, ran back in the house bawling.
That's
my poor dad felt so awful. He went, my grandfather, who shaved his head bald, my poor father went right into the men's room, the men's bathroom, and shaved the mustache right off.
That was the right thing to do. Hey, Joe, thanks for the call.
Absolutely.
We appreciate it.
But that is a good time to grow a beard when you're losing your hair. It sort of makes things
equal.
Balancing.
Yeah,
the balancing, I think it's very important. Steven says he does not grow a beard, but he does employ a fake beard when he's buying Plan B at the local CVS. Thank you, Stephen.
By the way, I had a beard when I lived.
Don't get arrested, Stephen.
In between my college and law school years, I've told you I had a beard, and maybe the worst beard. Those beards that never quite do it. But that's not the bad part. A lot of beards don't fully grow in, like the Tuukka Rask thing Steve Conner I was talking about. My mustache never met the beard. You have the thing on the side of your lips where it doesn't meet. No, it was
painful. Like sort of a racing stripe on either side.
People
of
would
your
avert
mouth?
Their eyes every time they would pass me on Commercial Street. Let's go to Helen in New Bedford.
Tragic.
You're on with Jim and Marjorie on Boston Public Radio. Hey there, Helen.
Hi, Helen.
I have great respect for the Bruins, but I'm absolutely thumbed down on beards.
Why is that? I cannot stand them. Why is that?
I really don't like them. A lot of them are not well-groomed, so they look kind of scraggly. They can be really coarse and rough when it comes to kissing.
Mm-hmm.
When you get gray in your beard, it really makes people look old, whether they think so or not. And I'm just totally not a fan of beards. The whole issue of weak chins, absolutely true.
It is true. They're everywhere.
Helen, you sound like you've been preparing for this call for weeks,
now,
actually.
Helen, what about...
My husband and I have an ongoing beard argument, because in the winter, he grows a beard, and I absolutely hate it. And he says how it keeps him warm, and it's nice for, he's old now, so he has a gray beard, and he looks like Santa, and he likes that. But really, he just looks like he's 150 years old.
A little passive-aggressive on his part, don't you think? Helen, thank you for a great call. We appreciate it.
Let's squeeze in Angela from Rhode Island. What do you think about beards, Angela?
Hi. Well, I think that what the Bruins are doing, that's great. But my husband does not have a beard. Our son, however, does. My brother does, too. And I think my son's reasoning is that he looks young without the beard. He's a handsome guy, and I think he looks a lot better clean-shaven.
How old is he? How old is your kid?
He's 25, and he's going to medical school next year. But he's attractive with the beard or without it, but I think he looks a lot better. I'm his mom. I like him better clean shaven.
Well, Angela, how about the 3 or 4 day stubble thing? That is deemed to be the sexiest of all.
Well, I don't think he asked that question about her son.
Not
Marjorie.
About her son, but about not about your son, Angela, but about men in general. The Don Johnson look.
I guess it looks okay, but really, I'm a fan of clean shaven.
Yeah.
I just like the clean-shaven look. I think, you know, show off your bone structure. It looks great. And, yeah, no.
Can you believe the calls are this thoughtful on this topic? Thank you so much for the call. We're squeezing one more in really quickly. It's a Bruin-connected kind of thing. Steve, you're in Boston. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Shoot.
Hi, I've been shaved for a couple of days. I'm not going to until we bring back the cup.
Good for you.
Yeah, and I'm doing the same thing. I didn't shave until Johnny Damon went way down south to forever.
Now, Steve, do you feel as though with the beard you have a certain je ne sais quoi when you meet new women in your life?
Oh, yeah, they dig it.
You know, Steve, I want you to know, in solidarity with you, I'm not going to shave till the New England Revolution win the soccer championship. What do you think of that, Steve?
Don't.
Steve, thank you for the call. We appreciate your time.
So last week we talked about whether there should be age restrictions when it comes to our legislators. Today we're asking, should there be age limit with rock stars? Why am I asking? Because the Rolling Stones are in town today. They're in town Friday. They're getting up there. They're pushing 70. Is that a little bit too much moss for your taste? Well, conversation is next, 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Whitey Bulger is now on trial in Boston. I'm Emily Rooney. Join me as we step back in time to look at the crimes, the accomplices, and the victims of James Whitey Bulger on Greater Boston, tonight at 7 on WGBH2.
I'm Adam Riley.
I'm Ibi Caputo.
I'm Philip Martin.
I'm Liz Alessi.
I live here.
And I report here.
They call it the hub. I don't think I really understood what that meant until I got here, but it is. It's a really important city, and it's a really special city.
WGBH.
Boston Public Radio.
This program is on WGBH thanks to you and Boston Private Bank, helping business owners, entrepreneurs, nonprofits, and families manage their banking and investment needs. This is your time. This is your private bank. Boston Private Bank. BostonPrivateBank.com.
And EBSCOhost, informing the world. EBSCO's technical managers and software engineers use emerging technologies to return results for over 100 million search requests per day. Over 40 open technology positions at EBSCOhost.com.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. As you know, tonight, the Rolling Stones perform one of two concerts at the Garden. Mick Jagger, Keith Richards, both 69. So the question's simple. How old is too old to rock and roll? You can give us a call at 877-301-8970 if you want to tell us who you think can still do it. Now, joining us with his thoughts on that question is Paul McCartney's love child, the man behind WGBH's Curiosity Desk. I wasn't supposed to say that. Edgar B. Herwick III. Hey, Edgar.
How you guys doing? It's been 3 to 5 days since I've shaved.
Actually,
right.
You do look pretty sexy with that thing.
Thank
yeah.
you. Thank you, Jim. That's very nice. I got to say, one of the all-time legendary beards in the history of Frackville, Pennsylvania, which is the town where I grew up, is Edgar B. Herwick II. That would be my father.
Really?
It was absolutely legendary. Just a beautiful work of art. My dad had a beard, and he owned a hardware store, and he drove a school bus. I mean,
oh,
just
perfect.
Things that you want someone to have a beard to do. You know what I mean?
Majestic.
I could never compare.
How long?
It was just like appropriate length, right? Like so long enough that you would definitely call it a beard,
okay,
but not
let's
so
go
long.
To Mick Jagger the first. Forget Edgar B. Herwick the second for a second. What is this called? The 50th anniversary tour? Not 50 years old. 50 years they've been together.
I know,
as a band.
It's kind of unbelievable. And they were sort of they've been trendsetters for a long time in music, but they've they've also been the trendsetters in, you know, we're never going to retire from doing the music. So ever since that, you know, it's gone, you know, a lot of people have followed their lead. So I started to notice there are a couple of markers, right? Like, so we're thinking about and talking about this in the newsroom. Like, how do you know when an artist is either in danger of becoming, you know, too old to be doing this anymore or has sort of jumped the shark, so to say? And we noticed there are a few things to watch out for if you're a rock and roll band, right? So one would be, you know you are an aging rock star when you go classical, okay? So this has happened. Paul McCartney has done this. David Byrne has done this. Billy Joel has done this, right?
Yes.
They've gone classical. We have an example of that. One of the great rock stars of the 80s, Elvis Costello, wonderful musician, and he went classical.
Now can they recall being young and idealistic before waiting?
That's enough of that. That is one of the worst things. What is that? What is he doing there exactly?
There's a string quartet. It's horrible. It's awful. So going classical. You got to be careful. Do not go classical. All right, another one. Another marker. You know that you are in danger of becoming, or you already are, an aging rock star if you make a duets album, right? So this is something that we see a lot of. Recently, we've just seen it. We were here talking about new music, John Fogerty, right?
Yeah,
he does a duet album. So he takes, you know, and this is often paired with, oftentimes, the duet album. So people who have done this, Carlos Santana did one that was really successful, actually, in the late 90s. John Fogerty's done this. Willie Nelson's done this. Elton John has done this. Peter Gabriel has done this. Sort of like aging rock stars.
Violation of your premise right there, Willie Nelson, who's got to be 80, is not too old to do anything.
Actually,
he's still wildly
talented. He's the exception that proves the rule.
And I actually saw him last year. He's fabulous.
That's
right. Unbelievable. He's the
exception. Know why?
Why?
All the marijuana.
Maybe it is.
It's
whatever it is.
It keeps him young. Now, here's the caveat with duets albums that we've noticed. And that is, if you do a duets album where it's you and an artist together, like Alison Krauss did with Robert Plant, that tends to work, right? It's you two doing it together, an entire album. When it doesn't work is when it's a smattering of a bunch of artists. Usually it's a combination of new artists and old artists. That's when you're in danger of being the aging rock star. You've done a duets album. This is oftentimes paired with another marker that you are an aging rock star, which is you're, quote unquote, doing an album that revisits your catalog. Right, where you take a bunch of songs that you've done before and you redo them. And this is often with a duets album. So we have an example of that. One of my absolute favorite bands of all time are the Kinks. I love the Kinks more than almost any other band in the world. But Ray Davies has recently done a duets album revisiting his catalog. And here's an example of him doing one of the great rock songs of all time with Metallica. This is brutal. This is offensive. And this is the man who wrote the song participating in this.
By the way, what's the name of the Globe reporter who's on our show all the time, whose mission, and made a movie about it, was to reunite the Kinks, the Davies brothers? Is it Jeff Edgers?
It might be.
No, I don't know if it is.
It was Jeff Edgers. Fabulous movie.
Yeah. Wait, I got to interrupt you. Can we at least agree one person who's in his 60s who can totally
here
do
we
it?
Go.
Well, no, I'll do it briefly and we'll move on. Springsteen has not lost anything.
I actually agree with that. I totally agree with that.
And by
Jim.
The way, when you're watching him perform, for those who haven't seen him 3 dozen times, even though I think he's 63 now, obviously he's a little different than he was when he was in his 40s. Totally. You don't get the sense that it's an old guy doing this.
No, I mean,
you
he's in great shape. He still does these 3-hour shows. Yeah. And, you know, he's also been able to do a couple things which are usually dangerous territory, like when you do a tribute album to somebody else's work. That can be dangerous territory when he did the Pete Seeger thing. But that totally worked when he did it. So Springsteen's kind of an outlier. He can get away with some
A woman on the phone who is actually going to raise an issue that I think is on your list, which you consider to be time to move on. Let's take this call and it can ease into your point. Carrie, you're in Gardner. You're on with Edgar B. Herwick III, Jim, and Marjorie. Hi, Carrie.
Oh, hi. Yes, thank you for taking my call. I'm a huge fan. I listen all the time
thank
to
you.
Your show.
Thanks.
Thank
who,
you.
Who can still do it?
Oh, my God. Sting. He turned 60 last year. And I saw him on tour back in high school. I have to say I became a fan when I was like 6. So I'm not really from the 80s. But he was so hot. And he wore like this knitted shirt. And it was just. It was awesome.
He's one of the sexiest men on the
Carrie,
planet.
Now, I have a theory about why he looks so well.
We know why, Marjorie.
What's yours?
Exactly.
I'm not sure what it is, but whatever it is, we should all start doing it immediately.
Me and friends always have a joke where if you have nothing to say to somebody, sometimes you should look at a friend and say, you know, Sting's having an orgasm right now.
That's right.
So let's hear what Edgar's take is on Sting in his 60s. Go ahead, Edgar.
With all due respect, I think that Sting has gone completely off the rails. He has gone completely off. He's got like an album of like, you know, hits on the lute. He's playing mandolins. He's playing stringed instruments that haven't been played by anybody in hundreds of years. And he's also recently done something which to me is another marker of you are an aging rock star, which is he's made a Christmas album. This is dangerous territory to get into.
Bad.
So I'm recently watching one of my favorite shows to watch, which is Later with Jules Holland, which we've talked about here before, which he this guy in England gets four bands on a soundstage together and everybody plays one at a time. So, you know, there are a couple of rock bands playing and then they go over to the lights come up on Sting. It's Sting sitting there playing some sort of guitar. There's a woman on like a Celtic harp and a guy with a stand-up bass. Sting has this knitted shirt which is unbuttoned down to his belly
button. That's the one that Carrie loved, by the way.
I know, full beard, and he's playing this Christmas tune.
All day we fought the ties between the North Head and the South. All day we hauled the frozen sheets to escape the storm's wet mouth. All day as cold as charity.
I love it.
Well,
I love every second of that Christmas tune.
We don't have the part here where, and then the woman comes in singing in some sort of Gaelic language that you can't understand over her harp. I mean, it's, look, this, let's just, let's, there she is. Look at the smile.
This woman, by the way, 93. It's amazing how well preserved she is.
Do we remember where Sting came from, though? I mean, can we hear a little bit of the Police? Do we have some of the Police? This to me is Sting. I love this. I guess you'd call it cowardice. Yes. But I'm not prepared
to go on. He's evolving, Edgar. Get with it. It's fine.
But here's the question. Should you keep replaying your original stuff?
No, you can't. I mean, there.
Or should you? Because that is like Springsteen doesn't keep replaying his original stuff.
Yeah, he has new CDs.
He has
all
new
the time.
CDs. I mean,
he does at concerts. He plays like half new stuff and half.
It's
you
look
silly being you know 70 playing I Can't Get No Satisfaction. Now they're going to play that tomorrow night.
I'm sure.
By the way,
tonight.
No, what's really interesting about the that's right tonight and I'm sorry on Friday night.
Yeah,
I saw Emily Rooney's show Greater Boston last night at 7 o'clock. They had pictures of early Rolling Stones when Mick Jagger was about 19 years old. And what was really interesting is he hardly moved. When he was almost stiff on stage as a young kid.
Yeah.
And now he's like Mr. Acrobatic. And it was just odd that at the age when he could have been Mr. Acrobatic, he wasn't. Then he evolved into it like at 50 years old.
He hadn't been doing enough drugs yet. And copying, I mean, Tina Turner is really, you looked at, I mean, everything Mick Jagger does is basically something that Tina Turner did.
It's kind of
incredible. And I think that he watched her and he studied her. And, you know, not to be lost is a lot of these aging rock stars that we're talking about are these British invasion folks.
Yep.
And, you know, that era of musicians, the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, the Who, Led Zeppelin, Pink Floyd, all of those guys, they were really into the music that was coming out of the American South, blues music, early rock and roll, and the Motown stuff of the 60s. I mean, those guys over there were eating that stuff up and looking at that and learning everything they learned.
Well,
they learned
and by
from,
the way,
that,
and a lot of the blues guys and a lot of the Motown people were playing until they dropped dead, by
the
way.
Absolutely were.
Let's take a couple of calls. 877-301-8970. Who's of an advanced age? This is in tribute to the Rolling Stones tonight and Friday night. Who can still really bring it? Let's go to Erin in Jamaica Plain. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Hey, Erin.
Hey there. It's great to talk to you guys. You've been bringing up so many interesting points. I actually edit a web magazine called Rocker, which actually only covers the world of musicians who continue to tour and record over 40.
Oh,
my goodness.
Really?
Oh, cool. And tell us, so go ahead. Who's at the top of their game post-40 right now, Erin?
Well, you know, I think the thing that I've come to find out, I've been publishing this website for about 2 years, and what I've really been surprised about is, honestly, that a huge array of artists still tour and record all the time, and we don't always hear about them, really, because of a lot of ageism in the media about reporting on people who are still, like, really making terrific records. I mean, the Smithereens put out a record 2 years ago, which, like, was mind-blowingly good. And I think, actually, here in Boston, we heard the Cars' most recent record, which also was really, really the top of their game.
Well, let me pick somebody who I was going to ask Edgar about, but I'll ask you first. Last time I heard Paul McCartney sing a ballad, it was cringe-producing. And then at the same time, I asked people I work with who went to the Fenway to see him. Yeah. They said one of the greatest concerts they have ever seen. And they're not just because it was, you know, this great memory of the Beatles, but because he could really perform. Where do you rank Paul McCartney, who's got to be, what, 67, 68, 69?
68 or 69. 69. I think.
Where's McCartney, Aaron?
Oh, 70. Well, I actually was not a fan of his most recent record. But, you know, I think that one of the things that people like to, like, it somehow evades us. You know, we're saying, like, Mick Jagger, when he was young, he wasn't moving around. Now he's moving around. Or Paul McCartney's amazing now. I mean, there are very few jobs that you could do, right? If you had a job when you were 20 and you kept doing that job for 40 years, you'd get better at it.
Yeah.
And for most of these people, I mean, you know, they've been performers and entertainers for years. And so by the time McCartney is like putting on a show, he's completely kicking it, you know?
Yeah. Hey, Aaron, thank you so much for the call. We appreciate it.
The thing to remember about Paul McCartney is, you know, those who, even people who sort of accept that he's kind of one of the great songwriters of all time or whatever, even in his early years, one of the criticisms of Paul is that he could go cheesy, he could go sappy.
Yeah.
So even when he was 27 years old, 26 years old,
yeah,
he would sometimes produce something that's a little bit cringeworthy. And he's also somebody who's fallen trap recently to another marker that are an aging rock star, which is you've done an album of American standards. The Great American Songbook, you know, with Rod Stewart. If you think I'm sexy and you like the Great American Songbook, you'll like me. And then he goes on The View and the women are falling. All that. Barbara Walters is basically in tears.
Crying.
I mean, here's the thing about Rod Stewart.
You can say
what you will about the cheese factor of him, and sometimes it can be very, very high. I mean, he's wearing a jumpsuit. He's got a ridiculous haircut. But his voice is a great,
great voice.
Great voice. You listen to those Small Faces things, the early stuff that he did, and even just his solo stuff. His voice is undeniably a great rock and roll voice. But let's hear a little bit of a standards album with Paul McCartney, who, again, I admit, is one of my favorite. I give him a wider berth than a lot of people. I have more tolerance for some of his cheesiness than most. But I do not like this.
You got to accentuate the positive, eliminate the negative.
Why is this happening? This is the man who wrote Helter Skelter.
That's bad. That's bad.
By the way, I've recorded the same song, and it's a better version than Paul McCartney's.
I mean, that's Paul McCartney. What's happening here?
Well, he can do whatever he wants.
Yeah,
he's Paul McCartney.
This guy's not a rocker, but Dee sends a great email about Tony Bennett, who's going to be in his mid-80s by now.
Tony Bennett
is phenomenal.
He's one of those guys that's in another category. And
yeah,
I think it's helpful, like, if you're in the category of a Tony Bennett or, like, a, you know, you're kind of a song and dance man or an all-around entertainer, you can get away with a lot of this stuff that rockers can't, right? You can do a Christmas album. Dean Martin has a great Christmas album. I mean, who's going to deny? It's Dean Martin.
And
he can do whatever he wants.
I saw Frank Sinatra when he was in his mid-70s.
Yeah, so
that's a different genre.
It's different. I'm just pointing it out. There are other people, Jim, that go on indefinitely.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, I just want to say, here's another marker that you are an aging rock star.
Yeah.
You have been knighted by the Queen of England. That one comes to us from our
producer. Wait, who besides the Stones and the McCartney?
Well, there is Sir Paul McCartney. There is Sir Elton John.
Oh, Elton John,
there
right.
is Sir Bob Geldof from the Newtown Rats, who did the live thing. And here's an interesting story, and this is an example of somebody who sort of sees this as a marker and doesn't want to become, quote-unquote, an aging rock star. In 2003, David Bowie was offered to become knighted. He could have become Sir David Bowie, and he said, no, thanks.
Whoa.
He said,
really?
No, thank you. I do not want to be an aging rock star and have Edgar B. Herwick III and Jim and Marjorie talking about me on Boston Public
Instead,
Radio.
He recorded his version of Accentuate the Positive. Let's go to Mark in Sudbury. You are next on Boston Public Radio. We're talking about aging rock stars in tribute to the Rolling Stones. Hey, Mark.
Hello. How are you?
Great.
I saw the Rolling Stones a long time ago, and I think they should give it up. My vote would be for Steve Tyler, who is the American Mick Jagger. I think he's aged better, still moves better, and sounds better.
Can I tell you something? My two experiences with Steven Tyler, Marjorie knows this, Edgar doesn't. I stood next to him in a line at a wake. And I thought, literally, I didn't know who he was. I thought it was a homeless person who I felt like I should give $5 to. But then I saw him as a surprise performer at Farm Aid in Milwaukee 2 years ago because he's a buddy of Willie Nelson's. He was brilliant. I mean, as good a 15-minute performance as I've ever seen in my life. How old is Steven Tyler, Mark? Do you know?
I think early 60s, maybe just broke 60,
yeah.
61.
I think you're pretty close. Mark, thanks for
only reason I watched American Idol. The only reason I watched American Idol.
He's 65, we're told by our colleagues. Mark, thanks for the call. We appreciate it.
Yes, it's something else Jim and I are familiar with, having gone to a Paul Simon concert. When was it, about 5 years ago or 10 years ago?
Yes,
we were the youngest
great.
People there, like by 30 years, and people were so aged they couldn't stand up for the encores. They would just
sit you say what it is, right? Did you say what it was?
Paul Simon concert.
No. Oh, it was Simon Garfunkel's reunion.
Oh, that's right.
It was their reunion concert.
The old Friends tour, aptly titled.
We were the only people there without walkers.
That's
what Margie's trying
to
say.
We'll be in walkers soon, so don't knock it, Jim. But anyway, what about Paul Simon?
Well, I mean, Paul Simon is, he's a great artist. He's done a really good job, I think, of kind of evolving through the years. He's somebody, I think it helps when you're in the category that Paul Simon's in, which is you dabble in rock and roll, but you're not considered a rocker. You know what I mean? Because even in his 20s, him and Garfunkel are making very quiet, very considerate music. He can kind of age through time. But he also fell trapped to something, which is another marker of the aging rock star, which is either your catalog is been turned into a Broadway show or you are writing music for a Broadway show. This is another aging rocker thing. And Paul Simon wrote a Broadway show. He wrote the music for something called Cape Man.
Which was a huge flop, right?
Which it ran for, I think, 4 or 5 weeks.
But wait a second. What's her face?
No.
Just girls who just want to have fun. Just won a,
there's different,
a Tony
Cindy
last
Lauper.
Week.
Well, it's Cindy different Lauper. If you're in a Broadway show. I think that's a fair – it's your fair game if you're in a Broadway show. It's if you're – if like Billy Joel's catalog has been turned into a musical moving out.
Okay, so very quickly before we go, who's number one amongst aging rock stars in the Edgar B. Herwick III catalog and who's the most cringe producer?
Wow, that's tough. So I would say probably among number one for me is Neil Young.
I've seen Neil Young twice in the last 3 years. 67 years old, one of the most brilliant musicians and minds ever. Who's at the bottom of the list?
Who's at the bottom of the list? Bottom of the list. Bottom of the list. I got to think about that. I would say it's the Who. The Who were so good. They were so young. They were so exciting, and their music was so much about teenage angst and energy. And you see them now. There's only two of them left. Two of them are dead. They still call themselves a Who. That, by the way, is another thing. If you look around and most of your
band members
were not
dead.
In your band or they're dead, you're an aging rock star. So
on that note.
Who. And by the way, Babo O'Reilly, which was a great song once, is literally on one out of every four commercials on television.
That
I mean, I don't know what's going on with the Who.
Hey, Edgar B. Herrick III, thanks as always.
Thank
we
you
appreciate
guys.
It.
I'm sorry about Paul Simon. I'm sorry about the Who.
He's a genius, too. But Paul Simon may be aging. He is a
this is
songwriting
Simon.
Genius.
This is Paul Simon?
This is from the ill-fated Cape Man musical, I think.
I guess I missed this one. Well, here it is. Edgar B. Herwick, thank you very much for being with
You're
us.
You're welcome, Marjorie.
Edgar B. Herwick
III,
excuse me. Edgar B. Herwick III runs a curiosity desk, and you guys should listen for him because it's fantastic stuff. Thank you again for joining us.
See you soon.
Okay. When we finish listening to Paul Simon, he's going to be back with Brian McGroy from the Boston Globe. He's our open mic guy every Wednesday. He's going to talk about the latest on the Whitey Bulger trial. Opening arguments began and end this morning. And then we're going to ask him about the $80 million man. Keep your dial on 89.7 WGBH.
Spanish eyes and soft brown curls. My love, come to.
WGBH and the Boston Globe announced this year's Boston Summer Arts Weekend, a 3-day festival of live music, arts, and great entertainment in Boston's Copley Square, presented by Citizens Bank. Mark the date now, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, July 26th, 27th, and 28th, a weekend you definitely want to stick around for. Check out the weekend lineup and After Dark events online at bostonsummerarts.com.
We love our contributors. That means you and Stonebridge at Burlington, who believe assisted living should provide choices such as art classes, a full-service spa, and a cafe. If you agree seniors deserve to live well and love life, you can find Stonebridge at nextgenerationseniors.com. And Davis Mom and DeAugustine, PC, attorneys at law, knowing the lay of the land, not just the law. On the web at davismalm.com. DAVISMALM.com.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio with Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. This guy joins us every single Wednesday at about 1 o'clock on Open Mic. He's the editor of the Boston Globe. Good afternoon, Brian McGorry.
Good afternoon, Jim Browdy. Good afternoon, Marjorie. How are you?
Oh, I'm great. And I tell you, Brian, I don't know about you, but I wish I was up in the Whitey Bulger courtroom today watching those opening arguments. Don't you miss that a little bit?
I miss it a lot. I actually went, I almost went down there. I just, at this point, though, we would end up in an overflow courtroom and it wouldn't feel the same.
No.
But the people who are there, we've got Shelley Murphy as tweeting, Milton Valencia is tweeting, Kevin Cullen looks like he's having the time of his life. I mean, this is pure theater. It's unbelievable.
Well, it's great stuff, and now we know, because the opening arguments took place this morning, we know a little bit about what Carney's strategy is going to be, that Whitey Bulger was doing loan sharking and drug dealing and bookmaking, not killing people, and the people who says he killed all these people, Kevin Weeks, Stevie Flemmi, and John Moderano, are so unreliable that we can't believe a word they say. That appears to be Jay Carney's defense.
It does appear to be, as well as throw in that he is arguing that Whitey Bulger was not an informant.
Correct.
He yep. might have been an onerous criminal, just a horrible human being, but he drew the line at killing people and telling on La Cosa Nostra. You know, he just didn't do that.
You know, one of the great sadnesses and outrages at the same time, Brian, I hope you share this, is while we all talk about this and talk about other things that happen in federal courtrooms, from Sal DeMacy to arguments on DOMA and Proposition 8, the fact that there are no cameras or microphones in these federal courtrooms drives me out of my mind. Do you ever, the people like editors of the Globe sit down with people who run television stations, radio stations, and talk about how to challenge, if there is a way to challenge, this ban on any sort of electronic device in a federal courtroom?
It's a great point. I have not sat down with local TV stations. I have registered my real frustration on this front with Mark Wolf, the former chief administrative judge at the U.S. District Court here. I think it's crazy that we do not televise this stuff or allow any electronics typically in the courtroom. The courtroom is a place where society goes to get resolution, and it should not be shrouded behind black curtains. It should be open to society so we can see how things are resolved. And it is self-defeating for the judiciary to ban all cameras in the federal courtroom, because if you are them, you want society, you want the public to be seeing these proceedings, to see how things are done, to see what fairness is, to see how the judges act.
Well, let me add one thing to that list, because the United States of America is prosecuting, for example, this day, Whitey Bulger. They're doing that in our name. They are, you know, whether people support the prosecution or not, we the people, the United, I hate to sound whatever I'm sounding like, we have a right to see what our government and our name is doing. And the notion that it's okay in a state court or a local district court, that's fine, but it's not okay in the haughty federal courts, is total and complete arrogance and BS.
You're exactly right. So I have sat down with Judge Wolf in years past. I have registered my complaint. I was at a conference on Cape Cod of judges that he invited me to speak at, and I addressed it with the entire collection of federal judges, saying it's ludicrous that we do not have cameras or recordings in federal courtrooms. And Wolf is, he's you know, a terrific judge, and he is, I believe, slightly more progressive-minded on this stuff. But, you know, these edicts largely come from Washington, and I think he might have been looking to make an exception. I know that when Nancy Gertner, federal judge, retired federal judge, was up there, she was looking to have one of her trials televised. It didn't end up happening. So we didn't end up making any progress, although they considered it at least for a while. But no, it's maddening. It's absolutely
maddening. Next time you have a conversation about this with the chief judge, feel free to use my name, Brian, and say that I am with you on this issue.
What I don't want to put the fear of God in them and just have the conversation.
Thank you.
That's playing a one card too many, I think, Jim.
Brian, let me ask you a question that I should know the answer to, and I don't. How do they get away with this? I mean, the Superior Courts are open. You can at least tape record or hear audio of the United States Supreme Court. How does the federal court get away with this?
Do you hear audio of the U.S. Supreme Court?
Yes, you can. You do.
It's not simultaneously, but afterwards.
Okay. But stay with that for a minute, though. Why can't we see
We should.
television of the United States Supreme
Court. Because we'd see Clarence Thomas asleep during the proceedings. That's why.
Well, there was a juror asleep today during the opening arguments, apparently.
I actually did a little research on this thing. And my understanding, and if I'm wrong, someone should email us at bprwgbh.org. My understanding is there is some federal entity within the judiciary, federal judiciary, which submits its own rules every single year, but they need approval of the Congress, which is generally given pro forma. The point being that Congress would have the ability in this case to say to the federal courts, we're not accepting the rule that says that the public doesn't have access through electronic media. So the answer is they could fix the problem, and they just choose not to.
I think you're absolutely right. But Marjorie, look at that. Jim Browdy is doing research like this.
How did this happen?
I had one of my colleagues actually become a real
investigative reporter. You know, he's going to be winning the Pulitzer.
Actually,
soon.
By the way, the chief judge, a friend of mine just texted me. You should know this. A friend of yours is now the chief judge, not Mark Wolf, Patty Saras.
Patty Saras, who you know quite well, is the chief judge.
Right. In any case, go ahead.
Should we blame her? This is
no,
her
we're
fault.
Not blaming her. I'm just telling you.
I love Patty Saras, actually. Anyway, we thought of you yesterday, Brian, when we heard that the guy you immortalized as the $9 million man has become seemingly overnight the $80 million man, Brian. How could this happen?
Well,
we should say who we're talking about.
We're talking about Tom May, the guy that runs NSTAR, and now he runs NSTAR and Northeast Utilities because they're both merged together. But he's gone from $9 million, which was bad enough, like you said, to $80 million. Great front page piece about him yesterday in the Boston Globe.
I mean, look, I've got to be somewhat careful here,
guys. Go ahead.
No, I really need to be. So, yeah, Tom May is the CEO of NSTAR, now Northeast Utilities, and he has, in his role over the years, collected quite a bit of NSTAR, now Northeast Utilities, stock, and that stock has risen, and suddenly, gradually, he has found himself with over $80 million in holdings in this publicly regulated utility.
That is a monopoly, by the way. Let's remind people that is a monopoly where there's no competition. We can't choose to go to another utility if we're not happy with Tom May's performance.
It's a lot of money. I mean, you'll recall, so what we did this time for this story is we hired a couple of compensation experts to look through Tom May's compensation over the last few years from NSTAR Northeast Utilities. You'll recall that was it earlier this year? NSTAR in Northeast Utilities refused to detail how much Tom May made in full last year until we put pressure on them, and then the Attorney General put pressure on them. We finally got his salary. I think it was $1 million less this year, $8 million this year, or last year compared to $9 million the year before. So we hired a couple of comp experts to look at it, and this is what they came back with, that he's actually sitting on $80 million in a company stock.
But by the way, if $80 million is not enough, I should say, because I know you can't take a position on this, I remember reading in the Globe not so long ago, but someone wrote, but lest anyone think ill of Tom May, please consider that he's also a director of the outstanding company known as Bank of America, for which he gets $260,000 a year to attend half a dozen meetings. In his world, that might count as philanthropy. That's a great little paragraph, isn't it, Brian?
Awfully well written, I will say that. Awfully well written. You know, you wish we still had that kind of writing.
yes, we do, Brian McGregor. Hey, Brian, moving on, since you really can't go any deeper into the Tom May thing, though, we will. Yesterday, we commented on the wonderful image of, for example, we turned on CNN. John King was with us yesterday from CNN, and that was shortly after CNN had decided not to cover Barack Obama speaking about immigration reform on the day that the first votes would be taken on this potentially historic legislation, and instead decided to have their cameras focused on a guy in Foxborough going, yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, maybe. Next question. Bill Belichick, and I mean this is a serious question. You deserve praise. Whoever made the decision, you or one of your colleagues, to not put Tebow on the front page of the paper today, but rather to put him where he belongs, on the front page of the sports section. Is there not real pressure internally is not real news, but is just like gossip crap to put it on the front page of the newspaper? Weren't you under pressure to do that?
We had a great headline of the Boston Herald. Good God.
That was yesterday.
It was a great
headline
for
Tim
Tebow.
But I'm serious. Isn't there?
But go ahead, Brian.
Aren't there people inside, and maybe even you, who say, let's just put them on the front page of the paper, give the people what they want?
Look, it's always a balance. So this was announced at, what, between 5 and 6 o'clock 2 days ago?
Yeah.
And we did, the first day, have a story at the – not a story, I'm sorry, a picture of Tebow at the very bottom of the page, teasing to a couple of stories on the sports front. because people are talking about it. So we put a picture out there. We thought that was appropriate. We didn't plaster it all over the front page. And Marjorie, that's not a shot at you. I get why you guys did it.
We're tabloid. We want those big stories on the front page. Yeah.
And you did have a very clever headline. It was very good.
Good God.
We wanted to be a little bit sober about it, and we had a picture at the bottom of the page, and I thought a couple of very good analytical stories on the sports front, and then, you know, that train has moved on. So Belichick decides to give a typically Belichickian interview about this and says virtually nothing. Tebow had a mob around him, said virtually nothing of any interest. So we put it right back where it belongs on the sports page. I mean, Tebow was huge, huge news a couple of years ago when he was actually playing good football. We haven't seen that in a while now. So the only thing this is now is, you know, Jim, you call it gossip. It's more a sideshow. It's not his presence here that we have seen does not discernibly have an impact on the Patriots, will not have an impact on the Patriots' performance, and that's what we care about. So we had a business story today on Tebow shirts selling like crazy. And the sports story, so nothing more.
Okay.
I thought it was appropriate.
Last week, we had a very fairly painful, unpleasant conversation, you and I, on the air, when it turned out that I was the only Globe subscriber who did not get Globe Insider emails. And we learned that you were conducting an interview, for example, with Dennis Lehane. Have you contemplated doing an interview with Bill Belichick, Brian McCrory?
Can you imagine?
What have
Can
you ever seen?
Imagine?
Have you
well,
ever
actually,
seen anything like this? What do you think?
Bella English had a great
with
interview.
With Belichick?
Yes, she did. A couple of years ago. It was terrific. And he was, I think, quite charming in the interview that she had with him. Don't you remember that piece, Brian?
I do remember that.
Yeah.
It was, I think I remember that. Look, my bet is he is selectively good. It's just rare that he selects to be good. Jim's going to love this. I can't believe I just got myself in.
Go ahead. I'm waiting.
I was at the Bruins the other night ago.
Shocking. I saw you on the glass.
Good seats.
I
good
saw
seats.
You. I was waving to you on TV.
Right,
you were on the Jumbotron.
And the Jumbotron focused on Belichick with his lady friend.
Yeah,
and
Linda Holiday, yeah.
His face lit up when the camera was on him, and he acted like the ultimate man of the people. He started waving at the camera, and the crowd erupted for him. So I think it's there. I think somewhere deep down there is an actual personality. It's just he so rarely decides to show it. He acts like football is, you know, fighting the war in Afghanistan, and that if we give away any sort of secrets, then the whole thing is going to implode. It's fairly ridiculous, but people respect him for it.
You know, in that spirit, I know you got to catch a plane soon to get to Chicago for game one. So let's let's just broach one more thing. Were you a columnist in Boston or in Washington during the Salucci years, both when he was the half of the Welducci team and then when he was governor, Brian? Where were you those days?
I was up here for a good deal of that.
What was your relationship like? What did you think of him?
I liked him quite a bit. I thought he was a very decent human being. I don't pretend to have been close with him at all, but I thought he was a really interesting guy and his ability to reach across the aisle and his just sense of normalcy. He knew what people were thinking and he related to people in a very important way.
You know, Frank Phillips was in here on Monday, and I didn't realize, nor did Marjorie, that Frank had such a close relationship with him, head of the State House Bureau, in his post-ambassador to Canada thing. And Frank actually, I don't mean this to embarrass him, he said it on the air, Frank actually began to cry when he talked about, in the studio, when he talked about his last visit to Salucci's house a couple of weeks ago. Of the whole spectrum of governors who you've lived through and Marjorie's lived through and I, he is the most normal, down-to-earth, real person of the whole crew, was he not?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, just get to Adrian Walker's column today in which Adrian says he's probably the only governor Massachusetts has ever had who's one of his best friends owned a hair salon, you know, out in Marlboro.
Yeah.
And Frank, you know, by the way, did an extraordinary job
of
very
piece.
Poignantly covering Salucci's descent with ALS. Just really, really touching stuff. He was the only guy who was really, truly local that we've had in a while, right? I mean, Mitt came from somewhere else.
Yep.
Duvall came from somewhere else.
Bill Weld is still somewhere else.
Weld
right,
came
exactly.
from somewhere else. I mean, Salucci wasn't just from here. He was truly of here.
True.
I mean, he understood what it means to have grown up and be part of Greater Boston in a way that no governor has since and very few have before.
It's true.
Yeah, it's just the Hudson thing. You know, Hudson. I mean, who even knows where Hudson is? And that's where he came from, and that's where he lived his whole life, and went to high school there, and lived there with his wife, who was his high school sweetheart, and never moved into the city, never moved any closer, and he just commuted back and forth for all those years in the legislature. And then when he became governor and lieutenant governor.
I forget the issue, Marjorie, but do you remember when the Herald sent a reporter out to
Maggie Mulvihill?
You're interrupting my supper.
Tell the story, Marjorie.
It was some horrible situation that happened with the Department of Social Services, and we were frustrated. We couldn't get hold of him. So Maggie Mulvihill, fantastic reporter, got in the car, drove up to Hudson, knocks on the door, and what's he doing? He's cooking pasta
That's great.
In the kitchen. I think he had a special bolognese sauce on the side, you know. And he said, "You're interrupting my supper," and that was it. I don't think she got the interview. Maybe she did. I don't remember. But it was a great little image of Paul Cellucci making the pasta in his kitchen in Hudson.
Hey, Brian, I'm going to email you these stories you wrote about Tom May to refresh your recollection. So check your email a little bit, okay?
I forget that I even wrote them.
Fine. Brian McGrory, thanks so much. We appreciate your time.
Brian McGrory is, of course, the editor of the Boston Globe. He's with us every Wednesday at 1 o'clock. Tomorrow for Open Mic. Tune in at 1 o'clock for Open Mic with Christopher Lydon. Adam Riley has been in the courtroom all morning long covering the Whitey Bulger trial. Emily Rooney has a special on Whitey Bulger tonight. They're going to join us up next. You're going to hear about Emily's Rooney with the principals, her interviews, rather, with the principals, and Adam's take on the opening arguments. That's next, 89.7 Boston Public Radio.
The economy needs consumers to spend more, but a lot of new jobs in that economy are part-time and temporary and low-wage. So ask yourself this, what kind of consumers does that produce?
Thinking about making any long-term plans, it's really impossible.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Our series Consumed continues, how we consume and what it gets us. That and the numbers from Wall Street as well, next time on Marketplace from APM.
Tonight at 6, here on WGBH Radio.
Funding for our programs comes from you and Boston Private Bank, committed to providing a personalized approach to banking and investing. Boston Private Bank. This is your time. This is your private bank. More information available at bostonprivatebank.com. And Sherlock Holmes, when you need help solving a difficult case, who do you call? One of the greatest Sherlock Holmes of all time is back. Don't miss Sherlock Holmes, starring Jeremy Brett, Wednesday at 8 on WGBH 44.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio with Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. What happened this morning in South Boston is what many thought would never happen. Opening statements in the trial of Whitey Bulger. Tonight at 7, in an hour-long special in Greater Boston, Emily Rooney examines the decades-long saga of Boston's most notorious gangster. She joins us now. Hey, Emily.
Hey, Jim and Marjorie.
And WGBH's Adam Riley had the pleasure, I don't know what the word is, the something to actually be in the courtroom for these
privilege.
That's what, very good.
Privilege, right?
For opening statements today, and he's with us now. Adam, thanks so much for joining us.
Adam,
hey guys.
Adam, before we even
we've been reading all your tweets. You and Brendan Lynch and Philip Martin all tweeting live from the courtroom. They've been absolutely great. So we sort of know.
A lot of good stuff, a lot of good fodder.
Hey, before you get to the opening statements, which we want to hear your summary of, we read with you and a guy from WVZ talking about the juror who fell asleep during opening arguments. Did anybody wake this guy? Yeah, I'm serious. Wake this guy? What's up with that?
He woke himself about a half dozen times and promptly fell back to sleep. So. It's always funny watching someone struggling not to fall asleep, you know, a coworker, fellow student in class. And this poor guy, I would guess he's in his earlier mid-20s, young man with a beard and he's spectacled. He just could not stay awake for the prosecution's opening.
Awful.
That kept nodding off.
And the judge doesn't
see each other in the media gallery. Yeah, it was.
But wait a second, Adam.
Taken as a bad omen for the prosecution.
Well, the judge doesn't say anything like wake up or get out.
Exactly.
What happens?
I'm not sure that she noticed. Maybe she thought he was really concentrating or being really thoughtful. My guess is, though, I mean, if what we saw today continues, they are going to notice. There's actually already a fake Twitter account called something like Sleepy Juror.
Yeah, I saw
which
that.
Was set up.
So, Adam, give us your take. Start with the prosecution because they went first. Give us your quick summary of what their case was to the jury this morning.
Sure. Well, what struck me about the prosecution's opening was that I felt like they got really, really deep in the weeds. They tried to give sort of Cliff Notes versions of. I couldn't even count how many of Bulger's alleged misdeeds. He's facing 32 counts in this case. And it was like they're trying to offer a little mini sketch of each one, tons of names, tons of detail. And I felt myself kind of swimming in facts and struggling to keep things straight as they're doing this. And my hunch is that these jurors, a lot of whom aren't that familiar with the trial, that they were probably struggling more than I was. I mean, I would have expected the prosecution to start with a big idea, you know, like he ran amok for three decades and, you know, abused people in half a dozen different ways. And the defense is going to try to tell you this, but we're going to tell you the real truth. They did a little bit of that, saying that he'd run amok for nearly three decades, but it was an overly detailed opening. One. Really, really effectively, though, at the end of the prosecution's opening, they showed pictures and left off the names of all of Bulger's alleged victims, the people he allegedly killed. And that was, I think, probably the strongest moment for the prosecution.
So what about J.W. Carney for the defense? We're all dying to know what his angle is to get Whitey Bulger the least amount of time in jail that he can.
Well, he has a few different angles, which reinforce each other. As we've talked about, J.W. Carney is going to argue that Whitey Bulger was not an FBI informant, that he actually paid John Connolly and paid other people, you know, at least one member of the state police, local law enforcement, that he paid off people because he had a lucrative criminal operation going and he wanted protection. So he paid them so that they would protect him. J.W. Carney is going to argue and preview this today that John Connolly kind of ginned up a bogus informant file from, you know, consisting of information he allegedly got from Whitey Bulger because he was known for running informants and he was so proud that he could pass off Bulger as one of his star informants. But that really, the info in the file that Bulger had allegedly given him was bogus and useless.
By the way, it's Emily. Is John Connolly going to testify, do we know?
I don't believe he's going to. I don't think, although I could be wrong, I don't think he's on the defense's witness list. Another point that is important to make is J.W. Carney is basically going to put the star witnesses for the defense on trial, starting with John Martirano, who he talked about today as, you know, he called him something like, you know, the scariest criminal psychopath to ever roam the streets of Boston, or words to that effect, which obviously means that if he's the scariest one, then Whitey Bulger isn't. But the argument
we have bad connection with Adam, so he's occasionally going in and out. But okay. Go ahead, Adam.
Are you guys getting me right now? Okay.
Yeah, we're good now.
Okay, good. Sorry about that. So J.W. Carney is basically going to say the three star witnesses who used to be Bulger associates, Steve Fleming, Kevin, and John Martirano especially, that they all basically print state's witness as a way of saving their own skin, protecting property, avoiding jail sentences or more severe jail sentences. So he's going to put their witnesses on trial while the prosecution puts Bulger on trial.
Hey, Adam, a couple of things. One, did Carney in his opening statement mention that Bulger himself is going to testify?
He did not address that, actually. I think a lot of us, myself included, have assumed that that's going to happen, but
Which suggests, even though Carney has said repeatedly he's going to be there, the fact that he didn't tell the jury, at least in my estimation, that he will be testifying suggests that maybe there's some doubt in the Bulger camp. Two other quick things. Bill Bulger in the courtroom, the former Senate president, former president of UMass, brother of the defendant?
I didn't see him today. Jack Bulger was there, Jackie Bulger,
brother.
Bill did not make an appearance for whatever reason.
And the jury, I know this is, what was the jury doing? Assuming that particularly the prosecution case was so detailed, other than the guy who was napping during the, which is unconscionable, by the way, were they taking notes? Were they paying attention.
Some of them were taking notes. I saw another juror who seemed to be looking really, really closely at his pen, kind of holding it up and turning it around. And it's weird. You see, you know, you're hearing these claims of horrific acts of brutality on the part of Bulger and others, and then you look over and there's a juror, not the sleepy juror, just to be clear, another guy, you know, looking at his pen, sort of turning it around or picking cuticles. People were listening. Most people seem to be listening. Some people were taking notes. Judge Denise Casper stressed that, you know, be careful. You can take notes if you want to, but when it's time to reach a verdict, your notes may be incorrect. You know, your notes may be fallible. So people were listening, but I know that some of my colleagues in the media were tweeting things like the jury is riveted, or you know, the jury's eyes are locked on the prosecutor or the defense attorney. And what I saw wasn't especially electric. Most people were listening, but it actually felt, especially after the pyrotechnics yesterday, it felt like things got off to a bit of a slow start. One last thing that I should mention to you, if I have time.
Yep.
The prosecution started by calling a former state police lieutenant Long, who participated in that surveillance of Bulger and his associates when they were working out of that garage in the
Lancaster Street garage, yeah.
Exactly. So what we saw was a lot of photo stills and even some video of Bulger, you know, around the peak of his powers, rubbing shoulders with not just Steve Flemmi and Nick Femia, another Bulger associate, but also big figures from the Italian mafia here in
Frank
Boston.
LaPierre.
Now, J.W. Carney said in his opening, Bulger couldn't be an informant for two reasons. He's Irish, and the Irish are never informants, which is sadly untrue. And then also, he didn't have deep knowledge of the functioning of the mafia. Now, the pictures we saw today undercut that a little bit, but I assume J.W. Carney has a rebuttal ready.
And one last thing before we go. Was Bulger wearing a suit today, or was he still in his blue jeans?
I call him dungarees, actually.
That is so weird. That is so weird.
He was still, I believe, in jeans, and he was definitely in a Henley, one of these long sleeve Henley t-shirts.
I
was a green Henley today.
Have you ever seen a defendant? I have never seen
a strategy.
A defendant.
It is a strategy, exactly.
But what kind of strategy?
Oh, he's just a poor schlub. He doesn't have the means.
Exactly.
That's ridiculous. I mean, the poor schlubbiest guys have a suit on.
He might look like a gangster. You put him in this stuff and he looks like a doddering old retiree.
Okay.
Exactly.
Adam Riley, thank you very much. Your tweets have been great and your coverage has been great.
Thank
you very much. So, Emily, how excited are you about this whole thing? I'm really beside myself. I can't wait to see
actually,
your special tonight.
It's better than I thought it was going to be.
Oh,
even
me
opening
too,
day
wrapped.
Except I just got to jump on what you're talking about with Brian McGrory. I mean, the tweets have been great, but most people out there, even people listening to us right now, they're not following this on Twitter. It's not right.
You're totally
and
right.
And in order to really follow it properly, you've got to go back and go through the stream and, you know, pick up not only Adam Riley, but Shelley Murphy and Howie Carr, for that matter. I mean, that just isn't right.
What, the tweeting?
The tweet.
No, she's saying the fact that we don't see and hear what's happening.
We have to get it from
terrible.
Them because their version is their version, but we're not hearing word for word.
No,
what's
it's
being,
disgrace. It's disgrace. And
not right.
Again, we talked about this before with Brian McGrory, but it's just disgraceful that we once again are such pushovers and letting the federal government
Absolutely.
Say you can't see this trial. It's insane.
Hey, Emily.
That's right. We should barge right in there.
You have the special tonight, 7 to 8 o'clock.
Yeah.
And you have interviews that you've done through the years, including with some of the key witnesses who are going to be testifying against Bulger.
Well,
what's happening?
Well, that's why I asked about John Connolly, because I got one of, if not the only, television interview with John Connolly back in 1998, before he was indicted, I should say.
We should say former FBI guy who was the protector, handler of Bulger,
chief protector,
who's now serving life in jail.
He was
in Florida.
He was in trouble, but he had not yet been indicted, and he knew an indictment was likely to come.
What was that like?
Well,
do you remember?
I do remember it because this freelance producer came on board to help me prep for that interview. I remember very, very specifically because he was so into the case. At that time, I wasn't that, we were all kind of following it. Whitey had been on the lam for 3 years. But the details were all just beginning to spill out about this relationship with John Connolly. So I remember prepping for that interview. I can't stand my outfit. I had the worst outfit. And I remember I borrowed a scarf from somebody. I thinking? Anyway.
You told me you should never wear scarves on television.
No,
Emily. You
never
told me
wear
that,
a scarf
because you
TV.
Look like one big scarf.
How skeptical were you at the time of the knowing what you
oh,
knew?
Oh, I was
then,
skeptical.
You were.
I'm proud of my questions.
I
was skeptical.
Wait to see
what do you mean you didn't know? I asked him. Well, did you ask if he ever killed anybody? And he said, "Well, why would I ask that?
That's
he was
great.
My
well,
informant."
That gives me chills.
Like
actually, that is.
Then
great.
I've got Kevin Weeks, who's going to be testifying. He was one of the mobsters. I got him right after he got
and
out
they
of
spent
jail.
Hours and hours driving around together. Yeah. Like they had like a routine where Bulger would go over to Teresa Stanley's house for dinner, drop off Kevin Weeks, and go and pick up Kevin Weeks,
meanwhile,
and then drive around.
I
for
asked
hours.
Kevin Weeks. He was there when these people were murdered. He claims he had nothing to do with the murders. I said, but you were there when they were buried. Yep, I helped bury them. We're to believe that Kevin Weeks only helped bury the people and then led the prosecution, led police to where the bodies were buried, but he had nothing to do with the murders? I was skeptical about that.
You know, can, just speaking about skeptical for a second, the issue that it seems quite obvious to me, even though I didn't hear Carney's argument, is that the case is twofold. His defense is twofold. One, you think we're bad, the government's 10 times worse. They're the ones who should be on trial. And the second thing is, as Adam Riley mentioned a minute ago, you're about to hear from three convicted murderers, one of whom killed 20 people. How many years did Martorano do in jail?
Not much.
11.
Wait, let me finish.
No, there's one other important element that Carney was talking about here. He did this whole history of the federal government pursuing the mob relentlessly from J. Edgar Hoover right through RFK to put in context that, that they were so blinded by their wanting to go after the Cosa Nostra that they were willing to do what Conley did with Whitey Bulger.
Conley has this chilling line where he says, we took down the entire New England Cosa Nostra with a gang of two.
That's right.
But so you're sitting on a jury. You hear people who, obviously, I'm assuming the prosecutor, when he starts interviewing or questioning his own witnesses, is going to say, you did murder. You were convicted for murdering X number of people. He obviously wants to bring out the worst. But then when Carney takes over, Carney is going to say, artfully, I assume, one, you're essentially a serial killer, which you are. Two, you only got X number of years in jail despite a long series of murders, making the point to the jury the only reason they got short terms and leniency is because they agreed to testify against my guy.
They did not admit to murder. They were both in jail, Weeks and Martorano, on racketeering, and Fleming on racketeering charges.
But so Weeks
Martorano
is involved.
Might have been on murder, but
You're a juror sitting there, and you're arguably in this era with the IRS and with the NSA, you're relatively skeptical of what government's going to do. How do you end up believing three killers or quasi killers who got special deals?
I think it's going to be tough.
I mean, the point I'm trying to make, this notion, believe me, if I were a betting person, which I am not, I'm not suggesting I think Whitey Bulger is going to be acquitted of the more serious charges, but it is not preposterous to think that if the prosecution doesn't do an extraordinarily good job here, that Bulger could get
these
off on some of the most serious charges.
These guys should be all in jail right now,
and they cut these deals with the government.
And there's another great point here. Stephen Fleming, who has been in jail for years and years and years, he was the boyfriend of Deborah Hussey. Yeah. And he was also the boyfriend of Deborah Davis. Whitey Bulger has been obsessed with saying he didn't kill these women.
I don't kill women.
So you have Fleming in the stand. Fleming blames Whitey for murdering these young women. But the jury could say to themselves, well, why would Whitey murder them? They were Fleming's girlfriends. And the theory that Carney talked about this morning is that Stephen Fleming killed Deborah Hussey because she was going to turn him in for sexually abusing her at a young age when she was 13 and 14
years
old.
He was dating her and her mother.
Exactly. Dating her and her mother. Exactly. It's kind of a filmmaker, Woody Allen.
Let's not go into that. He's not my filmmaker, first of all.
That's right. And he lived with Marion Hussey. He lived with Marion Hussey for years.
It's his adopted daughter, had three children with Marion Hussey.
This was not one of the children, but nonetheless, he was carrying out with this woman. So that's going to cast doubt on the Whitey Bulger. Prosecution.
Let's look at O.J. for a second. Beyond the fact that they came up with a brilliant theory, the prosecution, Marsha Clark, what was his name, Christopher Darden, were totally outlawed by the other team. I have no idea if there's that kind of differential between the
idea.
Jay Carneys and the Wyshacks and the whatever. Yeah. But let's assume there is. If there is that, if Carney is as skillful as some people think he is, even though I think he lost it yesterday in that screaming match with the judge, and the prosecution is as weak as Adam Riley said they were in their opening today, who knows what the outcome is in this trial? I don't think it's a given.
As someone who covered the O.J. Simpson trial, it was all about, and it was brilliant lawyering. This was not about domestic violence. It wasn't about O.J. Simpson killing his wife. It was about a corrupt Los Angeles racist police department. And you had Mark Furman, you may recall, get on the stand.
The N-word, right.
He was using the N-word, and you have a jury there that's sitting there whose brothers or brother-in-laws, or it was a mostly minority jury saying, why are we going to believe anything these people say? And you could have the same situation
here with the government in Boston.
With why should we believe this corrupt government who's made deals with these horrible people to get Whitey Bulger?
Well, as they say, when a crime is committed in hell, you don't go to heaven to get your witnesses.
That is a very good point.
That is a great line. So give us the take on tonight. What are we going to see?
One of the other interviews I got, and this one was 12 years ago. So this couple, Julie and Stephen Rakes, they were the ones who owned that liquor store in South Boston.
Oh, yes.
She tells this most chilling story, and she'd never told it before. This was 12 years ago that I got her to speak to me, but about how Whitey and Kevin and Stephen Fleming came to their home. She was at the liquor store. They go to her house where the babies are and stuff, and basically let one of the babies teethe on the mouth of a rifle, and they hand him a bag of $67,000 in cash and say the store is ours. And it's a little more complicated than that, but they just took this store over. They wanted to run it as some kind of it was the front for their criminal operation. When they got found at Lancaster Street, they had to get out of Lancaster Street. They needed a new location,
place.
And this is the one they took.
You know what's a great thing, by the way?
The state police were bugging Lancaster Street.
Unbeknownst
to
the FBI.
With these kind of moments, the Globe and the Herald always have these great graphics of where these things, that kind of thing. Yeah. I think the Globe website today has these addresses where either Bulger lived. After I saw, what's a great movie out of Charlestown that was made
The Departed.
I visited a lot of the sites.
Yeah, yeah.
I've
been to them all.
And it's but I'm so
Number
into
two,
doing
Street.
The same thing,
yeah,
by the way.
That's right.
And this Bulger thing. It is so cool.
Well, we have it on our website, too, Doug.
We do?
Brendan Lynch has done a great job.
Well, I did stand-ups for the original documentary I did 12 years ago, and I was at all those locations.
You were?
So,
Oh, that's great.
The liquor store is right at the Rotary right next to the housing project.
Yeah.
And
now it's like the South Boston Liquor Mart or something like that.
That's right. Next to St. Monica's Church. Yeah.
Look at the smile on your face. Marjorie is like, I'm into it, but nowhere near as much as you two are, even though my level is rising day by day.
I have family members in the Irish mob, Jim.
Hey, Emily, anyway, we'll be looking forward to it tonight.
Thanks,
7-8, right?
Yep.
That's the deal. Emily Rooney, thank you. Adam Riley, thank you.
I'll be glued to my set, Emily Rooney.
Make that two of us.
So everybody knows what kind of influence Whitey Bulger has had on Boston, but how about Whitey Bulger's influence on Hollywood or Hollywood's influence on him? Joining us to talk about the role of the informant, how it's been portrayed on the big screen, is film critic Garen Daly, also the director of the forthcoming documentary, The Orson Welles Complex. He's going to be with us up next.
And I'm here to watch you do. Give her just a bottom of the table, just a bottom of the two.
If you love high style in men's fashion, then you know the name Oswald Boateng. He says his own love affair with fashion goes way back.
I had my first bespoke suit made when I was about 5 years old.
We'll hear about the British designer's signature style next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 2, here on 89.7 WGBH.
WGBH programs exist because of you. And the Museum of Science, where you can uncover a portal to ancient times at the new Dead Sea Scrolls exhibit. See what life was really like over 2,000 years ago. More information at mos.org. And Orchard Cove in Canton, an independent senior community. You can learn how to prepare smart foods from Legal Seafood chefs on Wednesday, June 26th at 1:30 p.m. More information at orchardcovelive.org.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. We just heard Adam Riley tell us from the Moakley Courthouse in South Boston that J.W. Carney, who of course is the defense lawyer for Whitey Bulger, said his client was not an informant, but that's not going to stop us anyway. Here to talk about the role of the informant as he or she has been portrayed in the big screen is film critic Garen Daly. Garen is also the director, I am dying for this, the director of the forthcoming documentary, The Orson Welles Complex. Garen, it's great to see you.
Hi, Jim.
When's the movie coming out, by the way?
Probably April 8th, 2014, which would be the day that the Orson Welles started in 1969.
That is fabulous.
How perfect is that?
Yeah, that's the goal.
So the informant movie I know best is one that involves actually not one informant, but two informants.
You must be talking about The Departed.
I am talking about Departed, yes.
It's a great film. I mean, it's just, I mean, first of all, it's based on that Hong Kong film, and they adapted it, and everyone knows that when you watch the film that you're watching Whitey Bulger.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the part that I really like more than anything.
But I thought, I was confused when I went to see the movie, ill-informed me, that I thought this was about Whitey Bulger. Then I get in there and I said, well, this isn't quite about Bulger, because it's all filmed in Boston, right?
It is filmed in Boston. And what's really nice about it is you have double informants.
Yeah.
You have a mole going into an organization of crime headed by Frank Costello, a.k.a. Or Jack Nicholson. And then you've got Matt Damon playing a mole in the police department, both informing on each other. And it's just it's almost operatic. It's so much fun.
Speaking of the opera, you want to hear a little bit piece of the opera? So gangster Frank Costello, as Garen just said, obviously modeled on Whitey Bulger and played by the brilliant Jack Nicholson, is talking to undercover cop Billy Costigan, played by Leonardo DiCaprio, about an informant and his crew. Little does he know, I love this, that Costigan is the informant. Listen.
I'm sure by now you know I got an informer in my outfit. Cop, state east, Boston Police Department. I'm not sure.
Jesus Christ. You sure it's not the FBI?
Yeah. It ain't the FBI. You know, past a situation like this, I kill everybody. Everybody that works for me.
That is almost perfect. That is as good as it gets.
Well, you have to understand that when they were probably scripting this film, they said, okay, how do we incorporate what is real and what's not real to really make a great dramatic effect? And they do it wonderfully. They really do.
So
that scene at the end, remember, of Jack Nicholson? I shouldn't give it away.
You can give it away. It's out on DVD.
Yeah, when he's dying in that trash bin.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just a great scene, isn't it?
He is brilliant.
And Matt Damon, the whole movie. Oh, I have to go see it again now. I'm all excited.
So when we decided we were going to talk about informant films, we heard you were coming. I'm embarrassed to say I could only think of one. And it was.
Really?
I know. But then I saw The Departed. Go down a list. What's the best one on the list, according to Garen Daly?
Oh, well, first of all.
Or near the top of the list.
I would say Monument Ave. The one about Charlestown, again, with Dennis Leary. That's a really good one. If you want to go back in history, there's John Ford's The Informer from 1935, which is a story about a guy who rats out one of his friends to the British, who's in the IRA, and then has this really bad guilt trip throughout the rest of the movie. There's On the Waterfront, which is...
Oh, God, that's right.
Oh, and what's great about On the Waterfront is it's directed by Elia Kazan and Lee J. Cobb is in it, and both of those guys ratted out people to the House of Un-American Activities, and so this is their apology film.
That's saying, right.
Justifying why they did it. So it's got this wonderful double meaning.
Excuse me, I didn't know about Monument Ave with Dennis Leary. That's a really good one.
I should get that
on Netflix.
Yeah. Oh, maybe again, all these films that take place in Boston, you know, Gone Baby Gone, all of them, it really exposes that kind of tribal, very insular community that is very much a part of the
Well, Charlestown was legendary for the protecting code of silence, protecting all the murderers.
Same
those poor
thing
mothers
with Southie for a long
trying
time.
To get some justice for their killed sons could never get any.
Now it's memorable for a Spalding rehab. That's what people must have said.
I guess. It's so different now.
Does Serpico fall in this list?
Oh, Serpico.
Al Pacino's brilliant. Tell the story for those, because it's old. Tell the story for people who don't know.
It's not that old.
Well, it is. It's decades. It wasn't made in
76. And what's interesting about Serpico, first of all, is that the informant is Frank Serpico, who is a undercover cop who is straight. And there's so much corruption going on within the New York Police Department that he's forced to rat out everyone to clean it up. And the part that I really like about Serpico is, first of all, Al Pacino plays Serpico.
He's great.
But is that he is actually an idealistic informant. And for the most part, when you look at informant films or people who are informants, they're usually not very likable. They're usually, you know, their motivations are not very good. And in Serpico, because... I think we should say
there was a Frank Serpico.
Right,
this is not a fictional, this is a real story.
True story, yeah. There was a Frank Serpico. It was, you know, made headlines all over the place. But the fact is that he did it for honorable reasons.
Can we hear a little bit of this? This is Serpico. The first voice you hear is the great Al Pacino.
Captain, I think it's only fair to tell you. I've been to outside agency. I'm going to go to more if I have to.
Holy mother of God!
Frank, we wash our own laundry around here.
Oh, yeah?
Now, you could be brought up in charges for this.
I always thought so, but the reality is, sir, we do not wash our own laundry.
Sir,
it just gets dirty.
You are in trouble.
I don't care if I'm in trouble. I don't care who gets it anymore, including myself. Because if I have to go to outside agencies to get somebody to hear my
outside
story,
agency.
Well, where am I going to go?
You hear me, Sir Preco? Stay away from
where
me.
Where am I going to go?
You just wait until you hear from me.
These are great movies. These are really great.
They're gritty.
Movies.
They're
I'm
wonderful.
I'm going to spend another weekend hold up for these movies.
Well, you know, you should start with Angels with Dirty Faces.
Okay. I haven't seen that one for years.
1938. And again, we can make some connections here. Pat O'Brien plays a priest. James Cagney plays the boy who turned bad. And they're friends. And it's all about the code of silence and don't rat out anybody. And in the end, I mean, well, first of all, I think you could make a connection between Pat O'Brien as Billy Bulger and you could make James Cagney as Whitey Bulger because it's that kind of relationship.
Ooh.
So it kind of is apropos for our conversation here.
We have a little sound from that, too. Angels with Dirty Faces, 1938. Cagney was Rocky Sullivan. O'Brien was Father Jerry Connolly. This clip is from actually the trailer for the movies for the Angels trailer. Listen.
Morning, gentlemen. Nice day for murder.
Where's Frazier?
Where's that 100 grand?
Think we're going to pay off, huh?
Certainly. If I don't get that dough in 3 minutes, Frazier's going to be splashed all over the best hideout in town. I'm going to use your case as a crowbar to pry open and uncover this cesspool. I'm going to force the law, corrupt or not, to indict and prosecute and bring the light of day this entire filthy mess.
So does that hold up? I mean, is it great because you're the film guy that you are? If you're just an average viewer, like Marjorie and I, who are going to go home and watch Informant movies.
So fast.
How does that, this is, let me do the math. 75 years ago, this thing was made.
Well, first of all, it is a film that has all the cliches because it started all the cliches.
Yeah.
So that's always something.
So they weren't cliches.
Also, Humphrey Bogart's in it playing a bad guy.
Really?
So that's always an interesting.
A bit part or just the smaller part?
He's a featured actor. He's not
the
star.
Okay.
He's underneath Cagney and O'Brien. And the third thing I like about it is that the Dead End Kids are in it. And this is the first film that they were in before they became this kind of satirical comedy routine that they were back in the 40s. But the film actually started people thinking about crime in the city and its impact on kids. And a lot of legislation came out of it. So there's an historical aspect to it, the cliche aspect to it, and great acting.
Rahm Emanuel should watch it then. We have a caller who wants to add something to the list. Linda, you're in Boston, and you're on with Garen Daly, Jim, and Marjorie. Hey, Linda.
Hey, how you doing?
Excellent.
Jim, I know you love The Sopranos. Do you know about the show that was done maybe 4 years ago, maybe on Showtime or HBO, called Brotherhood?
I'm embarrassed to say I don't. What was it about?
It's about Whitey and Billy Bulger.
It is?
Exactly them. It is in Providence, takes place in Providence. There's a good brother.
Oh, yes.
Oh actually,
oh,
the
yes.
guy who cuts my hair, Alfred Mazzarelli, has told me about this.
Was it good?
I did not see it. Yeah.
It's
it was
excellent.
It was?
It's excellent. It was really well written. It was on for maybe 2, maybe 3 seasons, and I was so disappointed when they canceled it. I thought for sure it would keep going.
Karen, have you seen this?
I haven't seen it, but now, guess what?
And
a little binge viewing.
Are these people who are actually playing the Bulger brothers, or it's Bulger-like people? It's like
they're
the family.
They're Bulger-like, but it's so clearly them. There's even a scene where, in the beginning, there's the young rising star of the local Senate, the younger brother. He's in the Senate, the local Senate in Providence. And then there's the older brother has just come from being underground and hiding for a couple years, but he's back in town in his hometown. The mother lives down the street in a little house, and he comes in to a liquor store in the neighborhood where he grew up, and he basically bullies this young woman whose family has owned this liquor store for years to sell him this liquor store with no choice.
This is the discussion we were just having
Stephen
with Emily
Riggs.
About the
I
real
know.
Yeah.
Hey, yeah, they're called the Caffey Brothers. Edgar Herwick just whispered in my ear. And by the way, what a perfect thing for binge viewing, Marjorie.
Yes,
the Brotherhood. Hey, Linda,
get it.
Thanks for telling us about it. We really appreciate it.
You know, may I ask you a question, Darren Gailey? Garen Daly, whoops. What do I call you, Darren Gailey?
That's all right.
It's okay.
I've been called worse.
Garen Daly. Why in the Angels with Dirty Faces do they talk so fast? Is this some technological thing, or do they just think that's the way people talk? And they're talking so fast.
Well, there's two things. I mean, you're right about the technological. You have to remember that it was only 7 years before or 8 years before that sound became part of the movies.
Right.
I mean, it's the beginning of the 30s. So this is only, 8 years later. So they're still playing with the technology. The other part of it is that this is a Warner Brothers film, and Warner Brothers was trying very, very hard to get to be a gritty, of-the-street kind of movie studio so that people would come in. It was a very successful formula for them. So the fast talking and the use of jargon was key to making these films successful.
So, Ardrey Meagan, can I ask you a question?
Sorry. You know I have pronunciation
problems. I know. But what do you want to say? Because I want to ask about it.
We have a lot of emails asking about Donnie Brasco and Analyze This, where they fit into this whole genre.
Well, I mean, Donnie Brasco, definitely, because of the nature of the film. Analyze This is more of a comedy, and there's only a couple of comedies that work with that. Analyze This, again, was with...
Robert De Niro, wasn't it?
Robert De Niro and
Billy Crystal.
Billy Crystal, thank you very much for filling me in on
that. Any help you need, we're here for you.
Well, I appreciate that.
I didn't know it either. Edgar said it in my ear. That's the only reason I knew it. Go ahead.
But anyways, it's a comedy about, you know, a psychiatrist who is helping a criminal go overcome some guilt issues.
I think it's a riot, by the way. It's
very funny. But again, there are very few comedies. Another one would be My Blue Heaven with Steve Martin, who goes into the witness protection program. So again, this is genre tends to be very, very intense. And in fact, there are only a couple documentaries made on it.
What about Goodfellas? Is that an informant movie?
Absolutely. Henry Hill is considered one of the great informants of all time, and that's based on a true story.
Yeah, that is based on a true story. I think he just died a few years ago.
Yeah, he did. Yeah.
You know, when you say, is there a movie, speaking of Goodfellas, is there any movie, Garandela, you've ever seen or spoken about which more people say they have seen more times than Goodfellas? When you speak to somebody, you say, did you like Goodfellas? I saw it 39 times. Oh, did you think, I saw it 412 times one day. People who love that movie really love that movie.
They do, and they quote the lines verbatim.
That's true.
And I mean, so you can meet someone and have an entire conversation based on the lines from Goodfellas.
Garen Daly, we were talking to Chelsea, our coworker, this morning about a film that I don't think either Marjorie or I had heard of. We hadn't heard of the film, even though we had heard of the underlying happenings that the film was based upon, this thing Breach. Tell people what the film's about.
Well, Breach is based on the Robert Hansen story, which is a true story about a guy who was working for the State Department who turned out to be the biggest Russian mole, who gave away more information to the Russians than any other mole that we've ever had in our history.
It wasn't so long ago, either.
And it wasn't that long ago. I think they caught him in the late 80s, early 90s. Anyways, Chris Cooper plays the role, and Ryan Phillippe plays this guy, this young guy, who is kind of like put next to him to kind of track him and see what's going on. But it's all about this interplay between the government, the Russians, a young man, an older man, the older man being corrupt, the younger man trying not to be corrupt.
Let's hear a little bit of that. This is from Breach.
You're being tasked to headquarters, where you'll be riding the desk of an agent named Robert Hansen, considered our most knowledgeable analyst on Russian intel. He's also a sexual deviant. This could mean a huge embarrassment to the Bureau. You're going to keep an eye on him for us. He's a traitor, Eric. Started spying for the Russians in 1985. Good news is you're in the middle of the biggest case we've ever run.
Wow.
Music pretty heavy there, too.
Well, you know, it's Hollywood.
Who's the woman? Do you know?
I can't remember right now.
Okay. Is this good? Should we run out and see this, too?
Breach is good. It's not as good as some. I'll tell you what the film that you is probably one of the most underappreciated ones.
What?
The Friends of Eddie Corr.
I've seen it. And it's great. It's also a great book.
It is a good book.
It's a fabulous book.
But I've got to tell you, I have this wonderful story that I only tell very, very few people about, or anyone that we talk about, Friends of Eddie Coyle. The first time I saw The Friends of Eddie Coyle, I saw it in a bar called Frank and Stein's, which is on the corner of Mass Ave and Newberry Street. And they served hot dogs and they served beer, and they had a 16-millimeter projector on a screen on the wall. What no one else in that bar knew, but I knew, was that the bar scenes in the Friends of Eddie Coyle
by George Higgins, we should say,
okay, was called the Old Kentucky Tavern, and that was the location that the bar scenes were in.
That is great.
That it went from Old Kentucky Tavern to Frankenstein's.
Oh, isn't that something?
I know, and I love that. It's great. I saw the movie where it was shot.
By the way, the two most important food groups, Frank's and Stein's. I can't believe it doesn't exist anymore.
I'm sure it went up their nose.
Okay,
So what's that about? That's about the Coyle being informant for the...
Well, yeah. Robert Mitchum plays a small-town hood who gets stuck, gets caught in a truck ripoff and is forced to become an informant for a possible gun running. And so it's him walking around Boston in the 70s, getting involved, getting in over his head, thinking he can scope it out, and you get great scenes of Boston,
all Boston.
Dedham,
yeah.
Bank robbery in Dedham.
Is The Verdict Paul Newman's movie, would that be considered an informant movie? It was a lawyer's...
Another great movie.
I would consider it more of a lawyer trial kind of
yeah,
thing.
Yeah, that was a great movie,
and a great
movie
Boston movie. So let's do the list quickly for people who are taking notes. Give us the list of the six or seven we've talked about here that people should go out and get this weekend to get them in the Whitey Bulger trial mood, Garandale.
Well, this would be a binge viewing. You know?
Exactly. Go ahead.
Yeah, binge viewing.
You've got, let's see, Monument Ave, Departed, Friends of Eddie Coyle, On the Waterfront, Angels with Dirty Faces, Breach, Donnie Brasco. We didn't even get into All the President's Men.
Serpico.
Oh,
Serpico.
Yeah.
And Godfather 2, where Fredo is an informant.
That's a good one.
Right.
But, you know, I also, you know, there's two documentaries about informants, too. One is called Enron, the Smartest Guys in Town, in the Room. And the other one is coming up called We Steal Secrets. It's about the WikiLeaks people. And that is a community of informers.
Well, we're looking forward to it. Garandale is a film critic. He's the director of the forthcoming documentary that I cannot wait to see, The Orson Welles Complex, coming out April next year.
April next year, that's correct.
Garen, it is great to see you. Thank you all for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. You can follow us on Twitter at Boss, B-O-S, Public Radio. Follow me at Jim Browdy, Marjorie at Marjorie Egan. Tomorrow, Christopher Lydon
will be
with us. And also, we're going to talk about there is a huge list of hugely important cases the Supreme Court is going to render decisions on in the next couple of weeks. We're going to talk about that as well. So we hope you're here. In the interim, you can check us out on the web at wgbhnews.org/BPR. I am Jim Browdy.
And I am Marjorie Egan.
We'll see you tomorrow at noon. Bye.